This is Cradle My Heart Radio with your host, Kim Cotola. Cradle My Heart Radio, preventing abortion and helping those it hurts.
This is where the healing begins. Oh, this is where the healing starts. When you come to where you're broken within, the light meets the dark. The light meets the dark.
And now, Kim Cotola and Cradle My Heart Radio.
Thank you so much for joining us for this edition of Cradle My Heart Radio. I'm your host, Kim Cotola, and as you know, if you listen regularly, our mission is preventing abortion and helping those it hurts. And sometimes the answer for preventing abortion is to make a plan for someone else to parent this child. Adoption may be the best option for certain circumstances when there is an unintended pregnancy. And as my friend Melissa Oden has said, and maybe others before her, adoption is an option that everyone can live with when there's been an unplanned or an unintended pregnancy. And joining us to talk about the subject of adoption is Sherry Eldridge, who has a very unique perspective. She really knows the entire gamut of emotional experiences in the adoption community. And Sherry, it's just a joy to welcome you to Cradle My Heart Radio.
Oh, thank you, Kim. It's great to be with you.
I spoke with you years and years ago, and what has always stuck with me is the scripture and the idea that God would never leave anyone unadopted. You know, that God cares for us. And let's just start there, because I think that, you know, there's so much that we could talk about. We only have 26 minutes when it comes to adoption, but I really want to focus on this spiritual aspect and lay a scriptural foundation for the idea of adoption. I think it was some verses that you were quoting from Ezekiel.
Oh, yes. Ezekiel verses 4-7 says something like this. I'll try to remember it. On the day you were born, you were thrown out into an open field unwanted, but I came by and I saw you there lying in your own blood, and I said to you, live, thrive, like a plant in the field. And you did. You became a jewel among jewels. Now, Kim, I don't know if that's the right, or was it Isaiah 49:15?
I think that was it, because that is so memorable, Sherry, through the lens of an adopted child and through the lens of an adoptive parent, and outside of everything, all the cultural baggage that attends to adoption. And I don't say that in any pejorative way. There are real emotional issues that attend to adoption. But wow, to start there from God's perspective, I think is so important. And share for us the meaning of that verse for you personally.
Well, it's really was a game changer, a life changer for me. I had been given an assignment by my counselor, I was in counseling at the time, to go and visit the babies at the hospital, because she didn't think that I had gotten in touch with the loss of my birth mother, both at birth and at reunion, when she chose not to have any more relationship with me. So anyway, I gowned up, went with a friend, looked at the babies, prayed like crazy, and no lightning or anything out of the sky, and dropped my friend off, came home, and on the way home, I just start sobbing. You know how you just start sobbing and you can't see the road ahead of you? So I pulled off to the side, and a word and a phrase came to mind. And the word was jewel, and the phrase was on the day you were born. So I, being an avid Bible student as I am, I ran home. I can still remember where I was sitting in my study with my big thesaurus, you know, open on my lap, looking for jewel and on the day you were born. And that is where I found it, in Ezekiel 16, verses 4-7. And I will never forget it, Kim. It was like, I mean, it was just like all the pain and the shame and the no self-esteem. I had terrible self-esteem, which is very common for adoptees. that all washed away, and I saw myself through God's eyes. I couldn't believe he said I was his jewel. And so I just always, I mean, I rarely ever struggle with self. Well, I don't really struggle with self-esteem anymore. You know, I struggle with the normal struggles, but I know who I am in God's eyes. And I believe that is what brings healing for anybody, but especially for an adoptee.
Sherry Eldridge is our guest, and for well over two decades, Sherry has offered her unique voice within the adoption community as an established author and international speaker. And I want to hear from you your ideas that are encompassed in your book, 20 Things Adopted Kids Wish Their Adoptive Parents Knew. I mean, I think that's important for all of us to understand, because when we encounter families that include adoption, wow, we say some really silly things, some really hurtful things, some really insensitive, clueless things. And so we do want to, I want to give you the chance to educate us, Sherry.
Okay.
As our conversation unfolds. But first, let's share the story of your adoption, your birth and adoption.
Well, I can share it now from the perspective of being 71, and I have a lot of the history filled in. My birth mother was raped. And so that is how I was conceived. I was in the incubator for 10 days. She never saw me or anything. So anyway, I was adopted by a couple who wanted a baby so bad, and I was the one. And so I grew up as an only child, just fairly happy kid. But also I had attachment disorder. I mean, I did real crazy things like scratching "I love you, mommy, I love you, daddy" in our furniture, their fine furniture. You know, my parents didn't know what to do. So anyway, adoption was no big deal as I grew up until I was pregnant for our second daughter. I married Bob Eldridge, already had one daughter, and pregnant for the second one. For some reason, it came up, you know, all the subject of my birth family and my birth mother. Do I look like her? Do I sound like her? Would she want to meet me? I mean, is she still alive? So that is basically what happened. And then I started my own secret search at age 27, and I found her at 47. And it was not a happy time, because she could not handle the emotion. You know, that generation way back, there was so much shame. And so she basically said she wanted no more contact, which was devastating for me, but it was really the turning point for me also as well. a few years ago, I met my birth brother, John Perry. And it was through Facebook. Can you believe that?
Wow.
And I got to meet him once before he died. He was not in good health. And it was the most wonderful reunion I've ever had. I just felt so loved. I know he felt the same way. We were so close, just hit it off immediately. He passed away before I got back out to Reno to see him again. But that's basically my story. And so, you know, I believe I must be called to do this, because I've written 7 books. One's on the burner right now.
Okay.
And I still love it. I still love to write about adoption and help adoptive parents and birth parents see adoption through the eyes of a child. That's what the book is all about, that you were referring to.
Mm-hmm.
Because parents think they know how their child feels, and we feel the opposite way.
So, you know, Sherry, as I'm listening to you, and I hear you say, you know, you suffered from attachment disorder.
Yeah.
I think there's either a cliche or a stereotype or a giant fear on the part of society and everyone that, yep, these kids are impaired. And, you know, we just are not going to be able to help this child in life because of their beginnings and the backstory. But attachment disorder, help us understand what that is and how you have grappled with it, how you have overcome.
Well, it's, I think a lot of times it involves ADD. I mean, my mom called me wild because I was always very active, like a live wire. I stole things, even though I had every single pleated skirt and sweater that went together under the Christmas tree. I stole clothes from our neighbor's closet. I was very promiscuous, had no boundaries whatsoever. Of course, I didn't know it. I have just found out that I was a victim of sexual abuse from my father, who was, so that's, you know, I can quit blaming myself for that and understand more how, why it happened. I just couldn't connect with anybody. My parents loved me so much and tried so hard to connect with me, but we just did not connect. We were like three ships passing in the night. I didn't do well in school, but I was very popular. It was like I led a double life. I was very popular and well-liked at school, but in the background, I was, you know, leading kind of a shady life, keeping it from my parents. Very rebellious. So I don't know if that, you know, the dresser scratching incident, I think, really tells a lot, because, you know, I was also a pleaser. You know, I wanted to please my parents. I wanted to do whatever I could for them, because, you know, basically they were the hand that fed me, and underneath was my fear of abandonment, that if I didn't please them, then maybe they would send me back. So that's kind of a summary of my attachment disorder thing. I've recovered.
How do you recover from that? Because I know that you have. You know, maybe recovery is a fluid mm-hmm. process for a lot of life's challenges. It's not that you're cured, so to speak.
Right.
That's not that I'm cured from the afflictions that I have that fall under that recovery umbrella. But you're well and you're functioning and you're healing.
So happy. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about that process.
Well, you know, I've come to a new realization, Kim, through working, you know, mentoring younger adoptees, teen adoptees, mentoring online and stuff, that healing for the adoptee really begins when we understand the trauma that we went through. And it's a trauma to lose your first family. That's chapter one of my book. When we understand exactly what happened to us, or as much as we can, identify the repercussions, and then come to a place of acceptance that, yes, Lord, for some reason you have allowed this in my life, and I am not going to be a victim. I am going to be an overcomer. And I'm going to try new choices. I'm going to make healthy choices. That's my second book, 20 Life Transforming Choices. But I read an article by General Mattis talking about veterans coming back from the war, all maimed and everything. And society has treated them as, you know, damaged and flawed and victims. And he said, that's not always true. You can come back from the war and grow like crazy. And I love that attitude because, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of trauma you've been through, you still have a choice as to how you're going to respond to the life that's laid out before you. It can either be wonderful or you can be a victim, a poor me. Stay stuck in the trauma, stay rehashing it, and that produces nothing.
Sherry Eldridge is our guest. Her website is sherryeldridge.com, and we'll have that linked for you at cradlemyheart.org so that you can access all of her resources. And so let's talk about this, what adoptive kids wish their parents knew, wish that everyone in the world knows, because adoptive kids have to put up with a lot from strangers, you know, about your appearance and whether or not you look like people and you don't look like people, all of this.
Yeah.
So what are the at least 20 things?
Okay, the first one I mentioned earlier, that I suffered a profound loss before I was adopted. And adoptive parents are not responsible But they feel responsible, and I can understand that. I can really understand that because they can sense the trauma that we've been through, and it may have been glossed over. They may have not even been told about it by social workers, and yet they can sense it in their child. And so they kind of become codependent. You know, they do instead of just, you know, love, you know, be patient, patient. And that's where overindulgence comes in, and that's a real landmine for adoptive parents. The second one is, I need to be taught that I have special needs arising from adoption laws, of which I need not be ashamed. Adoptive parents say, well, you know, if I talk to my kid about special needs, isn't it going to make him feel worse about himself? Isn't he going to have worse self-esteem? The absolute opposite is true. When parents learn special needs of their children, in the book I have physical, spiritual, emotional, relational list that parents can use as a springboard to, you know, to look at, be educated, and then study their children, not with the kind of attitude that says, I'm going to study you, you know, but says, you are so precious to me, I want to learn all I can about you so I can support you in every way. And so parents can become the number one cheerleaders. Let me say that I believe that the special need that never goes away, and even though I am healed, I still struggle with the fear of rejection. I mean, I still read it in things, everyday things, and I have to remind myself, no, Sherry, you're not being rejected. You've got to flip the script here and realize, you know, this is not about you.
Okay. As you're saying this, you mentioned that there are a lot of things that are sort of upside down, you know, that we would look at behavior and we would get it exactly wrong. In other words, if an adoptive kid is acting out and scratching love messages into the furniture, and the average parent says, okay, this child needs to learn some consequences here. But instead, an adopted child might need something quite different, might need reassurance, might need, you know, it's almost as if they have a different emotional language and we need to translate it for our own hearts first.
Yes, exactly. You know, if my parents, I mean, back then they didn't talk about adoption at all. So they just said, oh, that's nice, honey. But if they would have, you know, come and hugged me first and maybe said, you know, let's just sit down and talk about this message that you put on the dresser, then they would be able to instruct me, you know, whether that it was not appropriate to do that damage. But they didn't. So, there's a lot of good writing out there. Karen Purvis's work about trust-based counseling, you know, how parents can respond to things like that is an excellent resource for parents to learn how to reframe those things and how to discipline their children. Yeah, putting them out on the back porch or whatever, that's not the best thing.
Adopted anything that kids breaks need connection.
Kind.
Right.
Yeah.
The idea here is that we want to reaffirm connection, not break connection, if connection is the issue, right?
Right. Reaffirm the connection, which is, we're desperate for that. And that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to connect with them, but I didn't know how.
Sure. And Sherry, you know, as we've talked to, I'm sorry, finish your thought and then I'll.
No, go ahead. I lost it. I'm senior citizen.
I'm sorry. I have so much that is in my heart to ask you. We've recently interviewed several young birth mothers who are talking about releasing a child for adoption in real time. And so the emotions are sometimes very raw, or the emotions are sometimes very surprising. And the idea of open adoption, I think, is still pretty new to a lot of people. How much do you, of the challenges and the difficulty of surrounding adoption, do you think attends to the older, more prevalent closed adoption system, whereby children were ever prevented from knowing anything about their heritage, compared with how things unfold today, where birth mom has a place in the family circle and is present for important moments, maybe once a year or more often.
Right.
What's the comparison there?
Well, I'm an adoptive grandmother also. Our granddaughter is 14 years old, and they have an open adoption. So I think I know the difference to be able to share a little bit about that. With open adoption, there is a relationship, an ongoing relationship with the birth mother and or father. And so, you know, there may be a movie date, there may be a lunch date, there may be gift exchange, there may be telephone conversations. But I believe that the adoptive parents should always stay in charge of it, just, you know, as a boundary. For the adoptee, because open adoption is not the panacea. The child still experiences loss, the loss of the mother and the father, the first mother and father, in their parenting role. So there's still a loss to be grieved. But there, with my granddaughter, there aren't the questions. There isn't the secrecy. There isn't the deep craving and drivenness that we older adoptees have because of the secrecy. I mean, our birth records aren't even open. This is starting in the United States. I believe there are 8 or 9 states, or maybe there are more now, that are getting open birth records for adoptees because they're sealed. Most people don't know that. That we can't even get our birth certificate. So there's a big, big difference. And, you know, I see my granddaughter in the open adoption really flourishing because she can ask her birth mother, you know, why did you place me for adoption? And things like that. But there also can be, I've heard of other cases where there can be ongoing rejection, like birth mother says she's going to take the child to a movie and never shows up and, you know, doesn't keep her promises or his promises. And that is, you know, a different dynamic, but it's still rejection.
Absolutely. You know, Sherry, I just glossed right over the fact that you said that you were conceived in rape.
Yeah.
And as we have interviewed a number of people now on this program, and which wasn't our primary aim was not to talk with you about rape today, but there it is, and it's part of your story. And I think that I would love to hear you just give us again your perspective, because when people start talking about this issue and what a woman needs after rape, they so often forget that circumstances of conception don't change the fact that there's another human being now involved.
When I found out about that as an adopted person, I just really, really struggled with who I am. It felt like a dark cloud over my head. Like, oh my goodness, I caused her so much pain. And she went through so much pain and then had to carry me for 9 months and, you know, I felt awful for my birth mother. I felt terrible about myself. You know, I mean, people call you illegitimate and other choice words that I won't mention. And for me, it just took time to process it. And what I came to the conclusion that has helped me more than anything is that my life began in eternity past. My life began in the heart of God the Father. He was the first to think of me. He planned my life before any one of them, any day ever came to be. He created me in the womb. And so I see my life line, and I use this sometimes with adoptees, beginning at eternity past and going to eternity future. Now, there are bumps along the way, you know, and one of them is conceived in rape. Well, that's, you know, but the bottom line is you are God's idea.
Sherry, we are out of time, and we're just going to have you come back and soon, because there's so much more that we could say. But I love that we end where we began, with God's love for you. Sherry, thank you so much for sharing your story and your wisdom with us today.
Thank you, Kim.
For more of Sherry's mission and her ministry, as well as her story, go to cradlemyheart.org, where we have all of the links that you will need for accessing her resources. Now stay with us. Coming up, we'll open the phones at 1-800-811-3003 and talk with you here on Cradle My Heart Radio.
Safe place to connect with others, finding God's love after abortion. This is Cradle My Heart Radio.
This is where the healing begins. Oh, this is where the healing starts. When you come to where you're broken with Him, the light meets the dark. The light meets the dark.
Cradle My Heart with Kim Cotola. Join the conversation. Call toll-free 800-811-3003. 800-811-3003.
This is Cradle My Heart Radio, and we are here live for you and would love to hear from you tonight. Our phones are open at 1-800-811-3003. 1-800-811-3003. And our resource tonight is a book called Shame Interrupted, and it's by Ed Welch from the Christian Counseling, the CCEF is his organization. It's Christian Counseling and Education Foundation. And Dr. Welch is a licensed psychologist and faculty member at CCEF. And this is such a great book because it's a biblical basis for interrupting shame, halting it in its tracks. And the subtitle is How God Lifts the Pain of Worthlessness and Rejection. You know, in our heart of hearts, we know that none of us is worthless in God's sight. He made us. And none of us has been ultimately rejected by God because of Christ and His precious blood shed for us. And yet these emotions can really limit our spiritual growth. So this is a great volume if you have been impacted by the shame dynamic. And if you'd like to get a copy, join us at 1-800-811-3003 with your question or comment. 1-800-811-3003. Maybe you want to talk about adoption and how shame may or may not play into the adoption dynamic. I was surprised in our social media posts this week. We put up a story on our Facebook page about our interview with Sherry Eldridge. And wasn't she wonderful? She's such a great resource. We just barely scratched the surface of all that she has to say and all of her wisdom and even her personal story of being adopted and learning the shattering news of the circumstances of her conception, but her victory in Christ in the way that she has handled that and has stewarded her thinking about it. This is what impresses me so much about Sherry and about every time I meet a mature Christian who has learned to steward our thinking. This is something that God would have us do and not have our emotions running us, including the emotions of shame and guilt and fear and all of the negative emotions that can become toxic if we really allow them to fully develop in us. And I'm not saying we should suppress our emotions. I don't think that's healthy. But learning to steward those emotions, and what does that mean? It means we're in God's Word and we are so absorbed in the Word, our thoughts are so absorbed with God's words and God's thoughts that literally our minds are being transformed by it, as it says in Romans 12. So that the truth is ruling in our emotions. is ruling in our hearts as well as in our minds and in our spirit and soul and body and strength as we love God with all of our mind and soul and body and strength. So shame interrupted and halting shame in its tracks, I think, is an essential part of the Christian life, not just for this issue of abortion, but for all of us. And I was really intrigued by Dr. Welch in the introduction to the book, talking about how he was very ginger in his approach when teaching a course on shame in a college setting. He said he asked a group of 100 students if they had experienced shame, and they were an excellent class, 22 to 68 years old, men and women, thoughtful, wise, adept at helping others through complicated problems. They were all on their way to becoming counselors. And he said, you know, so he was very careful to ask about their experience of shame. And he even, you know, refined it, hoping to see a few more hands go up. He said, we're going to talk about shame this evening. And he, you know, has anybody ever experienced debilitating shame? So he thought, well, people might, you know, he'd give them an out if they didn't want to raise their hand. And he said almost every hand in the room went up, 100 people. We've all experienced debilitating shame. Now, maybe you're in a college classroom trying to learn about that and be able to help others with it. It might have been a safer environment. I don't know. But how have you managed it? Have there been Bible verses that have helped you? Is there a spiritual truth or doctrine or teaching that has dominated your thinking so that you're able to bring your emotions in line with God's truth? We'd love for you to share that with the audience tonight at 1-800-811-3003. I'd love for you to share it with me. 1-800-811-3003 is our number. It's a toll-free call, and 1-800-811-3003 is the way that you reach us. You can also tweet to us. I'm on Twitter, at Kim Ketola, K-E-T-O-L-A. Or you can put a comment on our Facebook page, at Cradle My Heart, or just go to cradlemyheart.org, put a comment in the section, in the resource page, in the comment section. But get in touch with us tonight. Let your voice be part of the conversation. Have you ever experienced shame, and how did knowing God's truth help you through that? I mean, I won't ask you to talk about the details or give specifics of what made you ashamed. if you want to share, or if you're ashamed, if it's something you've overcome and you think that this is, something that is your joy to share, then that's great too. But it's not, in other words, we know that shame is a very close cousin to embarrassment, to humiliation, to feeling worthless, to feeling rejected, to feeling dejected, low self-esteem, all of those things, I know. But also, there's this wonderful thing that happens when God's love breaks through with his truth from his word, and we become free of shame's ability to silence us, and we become free of shame's dominance in our thinking, and it becomes just one more chapter in the story that God is writing in our lives. So 1-800-811-3003 is our number if you want to share a Bible verse or something else that has helped you to overcome the emotions of shame. And one of the things that I think is so helpful about this book from Ed Welch, which is our resource tonight for our callers, Shame Interrupted by Ed Welch, he says, you know, shame and guilt are not the same things. They're close companions, but not identical. Shame is more common and the broader of the two. He writes, in Scripture, you'll find shame, which is expressed as nakedness, dishonor, disgrace, defilement. You'll find shame about 10 times more often than you find guilt. He writes, guilt lives in the courtroom where you stand alone before the judge, and it says you're responsible for wrongdoing, and you're legally answerable. You are wrong. You have sinned. The guilty person, expecting punishment, needs forgiveness, and it's more almost concrete. But Welch says shame lives in the community, though the community can feel like a courtroom too. It says, you don't belong, you're unacceptable, unclean, disgraced, because you are wrong, you have sinned, wrong has been done to you, or you're associated with those who are disgraced. The shamed person feels worthless, expects rejection, and needs cleansing and fellowship and love and acceptance. Guilt and shame intersect when a particular sin is regarded by yourself or others to be worse than most sins. For example, you get caught with child pornography, you'll experience both guilt and shame. He writes, same-sex attraction finds itself here too. But what if your anger briefly flares at a reckless driver? Well, you might feel a little guilt, but most likely no shame because everyone else has done similar things. And finally, he says, don't forget that your sensors for guilt and shame are fallible. They can be silent when they should say something, and they can also sound false alarms. But false alarm or not, when we hear them, we have to do something because he said they don't turn off automatically. And, you know, one of the visions that we had for this show is that shame would be lifted because that was such an important part of the healing journey for me after abortion, was to be able to, you know, hear from others that they had experienced abortion as well and that they had experienced God's redemption and forgiveness and mercy and that they, you know, were living out their life now in light of his love for them, not in light of the great wrong that they had done through that abortion. And for me to be able to express that to others was so freeing and so such a source of joy. And to be able to answer God's call to share his love, you know, which is the thing that lifts us from shame. Love lifted me, the old song goes. Love lifted me. When nothing else would do, love lifted me. Out of shame, right? 1-800-811-3003 is our number. 1-800-811-3003. If you have ever experienced shame within the church that was unwarranted, maybe you want to share a story about that. I've heard many, many stories about, particularly when it comes to, you know, showing up at church with an unplanned pregnancy. That can be definitely an occasion for shame where the community says you have violated the rules about chastity. That can even be a driver of abortion. We've talked about that on this program as well. Or maybe, again, you have a story of something that caused shame. Maybe it was something that was done to you, but God led you out of that shame and into a place of freedom. I know that would be an encouragement to others listening if you would share that with us. And for those who call tonight, we have as our resource Ed Welch and his book, Shame Interrupted. Ed is with the Christian Counseling and Education Foundation, and he's written so many very helpful books that are very sound theologically because he digs into the scriptures with you, but he's also got that great counseling background to help you apply it and make it very, very practical, make it come to life for you. So that's our resource tonight, Shame Interrupted by Ed Welch. And the number again is 1-800-811-3003. And just a program note, we interviewed Dr. Welch a number of months ago, and we have the podcast posted this week in our podcast spotlight at cradlemyheart.org. We always try to post the podcast in a very timely manner, or you can subscribe in iTunes. Just go to cradlemyheart.org, and there's a button that'll take you right to the page on iTunes where you can subscribe and download and listen at your leisure. Because it really we are, our purpose is to be able to become a resource for you, a biblical resource for thinking through all of the emotional and spiritual challenges that happen after abortion or after an unplanned pregnancy. And oftentimes the issues spill over into other areas of life and it becomes, you know, a chicken and egg situation. It's like, well, was I devalued before I chose abortion or was it the fact that I chose abortion that I felt less than in the aftermath? And oftentimes they go hand in hand. Oftentimes that emotional landscape was already in place before an abortion decision and the abortion maybe made it worse or in some cases, you know, maybe pushed people into a depression where there had just been perhaps a sense of lingering sadness only before that. Share your story. It's healing to share. And this is a safe place. And we care. 1-800-811-3003. Join us. We'll take a break and give you a chance to get to the phones and win a copy tonight of Ed Welch's book, Shame Interrupted, from Cradle My Heart Radio.
A safe place to connect with others. Finding God's love after abortion. Cradle My Heart Radio with Kim Cattola. Call toll-free at 800-811-3003. Seeking to help others find God's love after abortion. Cradle My Heart Radio with Kim Cattola. Call toll-free at 800-811-3003.
Was so gratifying for me as I did the Bible study that went into my book, Cradle My Heart, Finding God's Love After Abortion, was how God in Christ restores us. And as he was doing that, when he was walking on the face of the earth, when he was restoring people, he was not only restoring the individual, but he was upending the whole system of restoration, clean and unclean. And we see that really in the story of the bleeding woman. And, you know, what I love about her, and I've maybe mentioned this on the show before, but I can't say it often enough. This is the only woman that was referred to in the scriptures as, that Jesus referred to as daughter. He called her his daughter. And she should not have been in the crowd that day when she, because she was bleeding. She was supposed to stay away from the crowd until her time of bleeding had come to an end. But she had spent all of her money and all of her time chasing doctors, and none of them could give her a cure, and she'd been bleeding for a very long time. And instead, when she touched Jesus, the hem of his garment, when she touched that, when she reached out for him, instead of him becoming unclean, he made her clean. And that's when he said, you know, who touched me? Power has gone out from me. And he gave her the opportunity to say, you know, I'm the one who needed to touch you. And then he publicly restored her as she fell at his feet. And the disciples were all scandalized, like, oh no, he got touched, he's unclean. And he's like, no, you don't understand. There's a new system. I am the new way. I am restoring dignity where I go. I am the giver of cleanness. I am the giver of purity. I make what is impure, pure. My power went out from me because she now has the power of my purity living within her. This is one of my very, very favorite miracles. And for those of us who suffer from shame, it's because, you know, of a loss of dignity generally, right? Whether our dignity's been taken from us or somebody is just trying to do that with words, or there's been an actual loss or slight. The loss of dignity is something that we seldom can do for ourselves in terms of regaining it and restoring it. But Jesus' words in the Sermon on the Mount take on a new dimension when we start thinking about shame and what they have to tell us about his upending the system. Because, you know, still, in their day as in ours, we think that, you know, to be honorable is to be honored. Right? So personal popularity, approval of the masses. But no, Jesus says that is not what gains honor. Riches and prestige and influence. No, honor does not rest on something that superficial. Keeping the rules and being a quote unquote good person. No, that is self-centered, self-dependent, self-righteous. Jesus permanently rearranges the societal structures of shame and honor. And Ed Welch writes about this in Shame Interrupted, our resource tonight. And this is our last call for phone calls at 1-800-811-3003. And Ed says, when Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount says, blessed are you, it's a really loaded word. He says, if you replace blessed are with how honorable are, you'll see what he's talking about here. So if you look at the Beatitudes, and you put them, and you change the wording from blessed are to how honorable, you see Jesus saying, how honorable are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And he says, you know, you can't miss that word poor in what Jesus said. It may have been the first time in history honor and poverty appeared together. His still attitudes linger that it's the poor, it's the fault of the poor that they're poor. That would be great for the rest of us. Then we wouldn't have to do anything if it was just their fault, right? No, but Jesus wants us to think about the poor who are the original congregants for the sermon. And then with the poor in view, Jesus wants us to go deeper. And he said it would be less than fair if only the destitute could be part of the kingdom of heaven, but poverty of spirit is available to everyone. Well, isn't that true? But this is such a great teaching. And he goes on to write about how honorable are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. How honorable are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. How honorable are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. And, you know, the bottom line for this is that all of these conditions can make us feel ashamed. When we're hungering and thirsting for righteousness, it's probably because we've been deprived of it, right? And that's a shameful place to be. When we feel meek and we feel powerless, we feel ashamed. We don't feel as if, you know, we're going to inherit the earth. When we're in mourning, oh my goodness, what can feel worse and more shameful than to be all alone and to be to feel abandoned by the world and your loved ones? Even if it's not true, even if people are pressing in, there's an isolation when we grieve that can lead to feelings of shame and loss. And instead, if we can start to see that how honorable we are when we suffer these things with God, it becomes a very, very different system. It's a new code of honor that Jesus has come to establish. And how honorable are the pure in heart, for they will see God. You know, that may seem impossible at this point, right? We know, though, that the kingdom of God is for beggars who have nothing. Begging seems within reach, but now the rules seem to change when, if we have to think about how honorable are the pure in heart, and we have to be pure in heart. But wow, you know, all that this means is that pure is possible for the poor in spirit. And to be pure in heart simply means to persist with people until you do see God in them. Because we all bear his image. And I think this is what Jesus was getting at in Matthew 25 when he said, you know, whatever you've done for the least of these, you've done it to me. Such a beautiful way of thinking and being in the world with him. And with, you know, our fellow humankind, not just other believers, not just people who are in the kingdom already, but everyone, as we look around us, it's just an opportunity everywhere we look to shine God's love and to share God's love and to live the way that Jesus lived as our, you know, as our template. Of course, we're going to fall short. Of course, we're going to, you know, miss the mark. If not every day, sometimes every hour of a day, I'm speaking for myself. But to think that there's a way to be honorable that has nothing to do with self-effort and it has nothing to do with performance, it has nothing to do with all of the things that our culture says we're to strive for. And then even when we attain them, you know what happens. You know, there's always an emptiness that follows. And there's always a lingering sense of feeling worthless. And you think, wow, I did everything I was supposed to do. I even got the reward, and I still don't feel any more worthy, if you will. This is a way for us to see how God lifts the pain of worthlessness and rejection. So I really appreciate Ed Welch's book, Shame Interrupted. And again, you can hear our interview with him in our podcast spotlight if you'll go to cradlemyheart.org. And I hope you'll do that this week because we have a lot of great resources. If you haven't visited the website recently and signed up for our newsletter, please do that. That will get you the daily updates with our Cradle My Heart Today feature, which every day we're sharing a story of one woman's experience with an unplanned pregnancy, whether she chose life and decided to parent and marry and start a family or become a single parent, whether she chose to place a child for adoption after an unplanned pregnancy, or whether the many millions of women like me who chose abortion as well as choosing parenting, and how God's love breaks through, and how there's still hope and love available for us in the aftermath of that choice as well. You'll get the daily updates about Cradle My Heart Today and our weekly updates as well when you visit us at cradlemyheart.org. And also program notes for our weekly shows. Coming up next week, I know you're going to enjoy listening with Sue Detweiler. Sue is a pastor and an author and She's also a radio host, so she's a great communicator. And she has a new book about prayer. And one of the stories in her book has to do with the heartfelt and desperate prayer of a woman who had experienced abortion, not just once or twice, but four times, and how God met her exactly at her point of need to answer a most desperate prayer. I hope that you'll be able to join us to hear that from our guest, Sue Detweiler, next week. Kim Cotola, and please remember us in your prayers as well. We are a nonprofit organization and a ministry that would love to have your support and your donations as well. And there's an easy way for you to do that, too, when you visit us at cradlemyheart.org. Like us on Facebook, join us on Twitter. We are there for you and would love for you to be part of our community, to join us each day as we're sharing God's love and finding God's love after abortion and unplanned pregnancy. I'm Kim Cotola saying thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been our joy to be with you. And remember, Jesus loves you, and so do we.